Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The American wartime and post-war emphasis on precision bombing and pickle barrel accuracy was for public consumption. The Americans wanted very much to distinguish themselves from the British and distance themselves from the RAF's area campaign. But these oversold phrases ought not to obscure the reality of American bombing in Europe. While there is no doubt that the Americans generally believed in and identified themselves with selective targeting called for by the industrial web theory, belief and practice were by no means one and the same thing. That's Tammy Davis Biddle, who we spoke to.
Yeah, friend of the show, and she's completely brilliant. And she is at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
she's a lovely person. I keep trying to get her to come to We Have Ways Fest, but for various reasons she can't come at the time. But promises she will.
Yeah,
and she's a leading world authority on strategic air power,
and that's From Rhetoric and Reality in Air Warfare,
which is a brilliant book.
And in that she quotes historian Richard G. Davis,
yes, who's and I should just bracket this, because the Richard G. Davis book is called Carl Spatz and the Air War Over Europe, and it is a monumental work of scholarship. And it's absolutely fascinating. And it's been my regular kind of, bookshelf fellow for many years.
Well, the thing she quotes from Richard G. Davis is, the American airmen judged themselves by their motives rather than their results.
Yes.
And they wanted others to do the same. And I think that's sort of at the... I mean, in a way, that's the thing that's been... That's the sort of football we've kicked around right from the start.
Yep.
From the, the thing... The U.S. Army Air Corps think tank, what it was essentially in the 20s and 30s, via these big personalities, men who talked about this, theorized about this, argued in bars about it and in coffee houses and in publications and at the U.S. Army Air Corps, and at the technical college, then being given the opportunity to actually put these things into practice.
Yep.
And even by the end of the war, even in spite of absolutely everything they've been through and the diversions from that kind of ideological core of what they're trying to achieve, they come back to this idea that they are precision bombing, and that they are they're not like the dirty, filthy bomber command lurking in the shadows at night. There's something honest about bombing in daylight.
Yeah, there?
there's something, for some people, American, that it answers some sort of ideal of who Americans are and how they see themselves.
Yep.
Even in the event of total war, and of course. This is Northwest Europe we're talking about. You've got to park what then happens in Japan and quite how
Square that particular circle.
But that's not the job of this series, because we're talking about...
No, and it's not the job of Spats and Doolittle and all the rest of it, and Acre and Co. As the war progresses and as the dominance of Allied air forces takes root over Northwest Europe and again in their targeting of the Reich, these discussions about the morality of it and what they're actually trying to do and ideology versus reality and all the rest of it really, really start to come to the fore. And I think we should definitely have a look at that.
Yes.
But I think first we should just have a look at what actually happens, the kind of sort of the narrative of what's going on. Of course, because we left it on the eve of D-Day, D-Day happens, and the strategic air forces play a really, really important part of that. And of course, one of those who's flying is our old friend Bert Stiles, who describes the kind of fortresses all circling everywhere at dawn and, you know, some 17,000 feet up over England. He looks down and all he can see is fortresses. And just these hundreds and hundreds of them all swirling, all trying to form up. And every kind of layer, there's a every sort of few hundred feet, there's another layer of them. And clouds dog the route across the channel, but as we know, the weather was terrible on D-Day. But eventually there's the coast, and Stiles and his crew are all thinking about the poor bastards down on the beach. And he writes, "The planes would be over them and the ships would be behind them, but they had to go in alone." And I think that's such a nice line. I mean, he's absolutely bang on. But the problems that the bombers have is they overshoot, because everyone, they're told, whatever happens, don't bomb the invasion force. But as we all know, you know, you can be as precise as you like, but you're not going to be very precise. And a lot of the bombs, even when they've got really, really good conditions, are not hitting the targets as close as you can. And when you're over a beach coastline like that, very easy to get it wrong. So they overcompensate. And a lot of the bombs go inland. But, you know, I always kind of feel this is, again, this is one of these sort of slightly overblown features of D-Day, because you've still got a hell of a lot of firepower out at sea. It's not exactly going to be helpful for the Germans to have the rear areas of all these positions on the coast.
I mean, they're a bit plastered one way or another. And the sort of proof of the pudding is in the eating, isn't it? D-Day is a success. I mean, the invasion is a success. This then means, at the same time, as well as the crossbow targets, the oil plant starts to sort of...
Well, yes, because they've done the transportation bit. You know, that has succeeded. They've destroyed every single bridge over the Seine.
They absolutely have.
All these marshalling yards have been absolutely hammered. And you and I will remember looking at Harris's Blue Book in the RAF Museum in Hendon.
Anywhere there's a set of points.
And a railway.
Gets blasted.
It's incredible. And you can see these photographs. You can see the scale of the damage. So that's work. So now you absolutely can take your time and do the oil plant, which you've already been targeting. I mean, you know, that mission on the 28th of May that we ended the last episode, that was to hit an oil target.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about the you know, Ike says, all right, we're favourable conditions over Germany, because it's summer after all. So a part of the big problem that you can't see what you're doing has passed. So the opportunity is to bomb with precision. He says, when we can't use it against crossbow. So that so shows how prioritised crossbow is. He says, all right, aircraft industry, oil, ball bearings, still in the mix. I'm a big fan of the ball bearings being in the mix.
I'm not going to give up my ball bearing ambition.
Really, there's something funny, because ball bearings don't work without oil. You don't need to go for the, you know, it's the tragedy of the Schweinfurt raids. You know, you could take ball bearings out of that list and everything would be all right, because after all, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, the way that their minds are gradually coming in on the idea that oil is actually the thing. But
but they are obsessed.
They're obsessed with ball bearings.
And they're just not going to be deviated from that.
That's right, And then Goering on the 9th of July, the Allies know he's saying this, the deep inroad made into the supply of aircraft fuel demands a most stringent reduction in flying. Drastic economy is absolutely essential. So, I mean...
It's working.
They chuck a ton of fighters up. When they attack oil targets, defences are immediately diverted, because the Germans know perfectly well how vulnerable they are on this.
So you're getting a two for one from an Allied point of view.
Exactly.
But all this stuff, I mean, you know, Spots can say, go and say, look, my old plan is working. Look what Goering said. But I would argue, having 2,500 bombers going over in a 24-hour period, plus 1,500 fighter planes, collectively, that's their job. You can have all these emphases, but it's the smothering of it, isn't it?
But this, as much as anything else, goes back to what the Tammy Davis Biddle quote at the start here, is that the Americans are saying it's not just that we're overwhelming the skies. We're doing it precisely. Our intentions are the core and the key to what we're doing, rather than the fact that we're simply smothering the place with bombs, and airframes. It's a tumble of events in the summer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you've then got the July plot, and that in itself, and I think the July plot is the key to how Germany then behaves for the rest of the war. I think it's the central event that explains why, you know, in the last episode we said this. How do they not know they've lost? Well, the July plot is the thing that means no one can address that anymore.
Yep.
It's gone.
It's catastrophic, the July plot.
It is, absolutely.
I'm looking forward to, we're planning to do that later in the summer, aren't we? And I'm actually looking forward to getting stuck in on that.
It's almost the worst thing that could possibly happen.
Yeah.
To Germany.
I'm actually quite down on Stauffenberg.
Well, look, with that to look forward to later in the year, ladies and gentlemen. The Americans then, there's another plan. I mean, and they're good at their names here, aren't they?
Yeah.
This is no Operation Fustian. Thunderclap.
Yeah, but I think this is really, really interesting, because this is that the whole point of Thunderclap is to just absolutely hammer Berlin. Hmm. Hammer Berlin.
Yeah.
Swamp it with... By night and by day, by, 2,000 bombers in a 24-hour period and fighter planes, and just hammer it. Spots is really uneasy about this. Yeah. He doesn't like it at all. But what's interesting is it is his staff within the US Strategic Air Forces in Europe come up with this idea alongside the Air Ministry and the Ministry for Economic Warfare.
Yeah.
Set Europe ablaze, etc.
Yeah.
So it never happens. Spots says, I feel uneasy about this. I don't think this is good. This is not good for our kind of image and what we say we're going to do.
And I
just turns around and goes, if this is going to hasten the end of the war.
Do it.
The whole point about Thunderclap is this is to exploit the kind of the situation in Germany. You know, perhaps they're all ripe for implosion. Yeah. And, if we just do this and that'll...
Well, it's 1918. Everyone, certainly the British are thinking in terms of 1918, and the July plot is a clear indication there might be a revolution in Germany of one way or another. The British, since the start of the war, have convinced themselves that on some level Germany's a house of cards. It'll fall in. The army won't put up with it anymore.
Under normal circumstances, yes.
Yes, exactly.
This is the point.
The July plot has made sure that actually, although they're taking that as a signal of this sort of fragility, the July plot is the thing that brings an end to the possibility of that fragility.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
So in August and September, they're resources are continuing to be divided between ground campaign. This is a bombing of Villa Vercage and things like that.
Yeah.
And various other operations that they're pulled into. Operation Cobra, of course.
Yeah.
25th July 1944. You know, Strategic Air Force is brought in that. Well, 8th Air Force.
Well,
and also crossbow targets.
Well, Cobra is an example of if you get the bomb line wrong.
Yep.
The thing they're desperate to try and
get it
right
all absolutely right to start off with, but then the smoke drifts and so.
But this is the thing they're trying to avoid doing on D-Day.
Exactly that. But also it is yet another indicator for all your talk of precision daylight bombing. It's nothing like as precise as you'd like it to be.
Yeah. And smoke,
Leslie McNair gets killed as
smoke,
a result.
Smoke. The result of the bombing. But you can't bomb without smoke. I mean it. But the point is that they can mount these sorties like that and deliver hammer blows wherever they want.
Is
the truth.
72,000 small-scale bombs they dropped, didn't they, on that? So the whole point was to not churn up the ground. Fragmentation bombs, that's what they had.
Yeah.
God, I'm 72,000.
If you're Eisenhower and the air guys have said, look, we can bomb precisely, we can deliver tons of ordnance to whoever you want. What else are you going to... You're going to say, crack on then, lads. Anything that's short in the war. And after all, the whole... it's interesting, isn't it? That distinction with Thunderclap is that Eisenhower's going, anything that's short in the war. The whole point of air power is the idea is that it shortens the war. Yeah. That was its initial selling point. So they're hard-pressed to say, well, you got that wrong, I'm afraid.
Well, even in February 1944, Spots thinks, as does Harris, that they can still bring a result.
Bomb Germany to submission, That they
but how he's going to do that just precisely, I don't know.
Anyway. Yeah. They're also moving supplies around for ground forces so that, you know, it's round-the-clock flying as well as bombing.
And they have to do this because of the oil crisis, yeah. because the fuel crisis, because of the shells and all the rest of it, because they've overreached. You know, they never do reach their culmination point, but they're on the cusp of it.
Yeah, all the time. And regular fans of the podcast will be delighted to know that Doolittle regards Market Gardener as having cost him four major raids and two minor bombing missions. The diversion of effort. Yeah, I mean, it's nothing, isn't it?
I mean, that's the way that's presented is what a massive cost. No, but I'm thinking, so what?
Yeah. Yeah,
you're fine. Doing it. If that's all it is, then great.
Yeah, exactly.
Why don't you do more then?
Yeah, and they're putting 1,000 bombers and 1,000 fighters into the air every single day.
Every day, pretty much every day.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, obviously not every day. Most days, that is a regular occurrence. Yeah.
And then in September, there's the great reorganisation.
Yeah, so those formal obligations, Chafe, end. Yeah. They're no longer having to support this great undertaking, Operation Overlord, and they can go back to doing what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Designed to do.
And in the meantime, they've become even more powerful. And although we've been pretty scathing of the precision thing, that they are getting better at it.
They are getting better
at navigational aids.
Bomber Command particularly, that's the irony.
They're getting really, really good.
You know, but Bomber Command is more accurate at bombing than 8th Air Force by this point. And the interesting thing is of course the relinquishing of control by Eisenhower then prompts yet another round of debate. Yeah. You know, it's so completely predictable. You know, Harris wants to keep on flattening cities, Spots wants to continue on the oil plan, Tedder wants to extend the transportation plan into Germany itself. They're all arguing about it, but actually they just carry on. They just all do the same thing. Let's do all of it. And this is the thing, it's not an either or.
Given how we've talked about the fact the Americans are more concerned with sort of the public consumption of what they're doing, or as concerned with that as much as anything else, their intentions are what matter. Is Harris right? Is the most efficient use of bombers in the end area bombing?
I don't know, to be honest, because I think the most efficient use of bombers is to do everything.
Yeah.
I think it absolutely you want to hit synthetic fuel plants. Absolutely you want to hit the transportation network. Absolutely you want to flatten cities. I mean, there's no question that if you're flattening a city, that's really inconvenient. You know, there's a reason why a city is a city.
Yes.
Yeah. It's because it's a hub.
Yeah.
You know, that's where roads meet. It's where...
So hitting a city does feed into the American idea of industrial webs. The pragmatism of actually what it's like bombing in Northwest Europe, with the challenges of the air defence systems and all that sort of stuff.
But if you think about the Mokau air plant outside Leipzig, it's not in Leipzig.
Yeah,
it's in a big stretch of open countryside in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
You don't need to hit the city. You don't need to hit Leipzig. You need to hit the Mokau.
You have to find it though, and
find it, and all the rest.
More difficult.
You know, where do all these workers live who are in these factories? You know, and manning the Reichsbahn, organising cargos and taking stuff off railway wagons. They all live in cities.
Yeah.
So if you destroy the cities and kill lots of them, then they can't do that, and you've got to find someone else to do it. So it's all part and parcel of a bigger thing, which is you've got air power. You're trying to preserve the lives of your own young men from your own nation, whether it be Britain, the Commonwealth, United States, Canada, whatever. The science and the data does not support any one
plan. Way of doing it.
They all have merit. Area bombing is obviously much more brutal. As has been made repeatedly clear to the Nazi high command, if you stop the war...
This stops. Yeah.
It's very, very simple.
The other thing is there's no what if... there's no controlled experiment at any point in this. You know, Harris doesn't say, all right, then for 3 months, I will bomb only synthetic oil and we'll get to find out the difference. Asking the question of, is Harris right? We can't find an answer because he doesn't try it. So there's no way of investigating that, is there? And the Americans in the end, for all their talk of precision, are essentially area bombing a lot of the time because
they can't help it.
There's nothing else you can do.
You can be precisely trying to hit a marshal.
Precisely
yard.
Bombing the wrong thing. Yeah, exactly. So there's a new bombing directive on the 25th of September, which is to say, you know, out of the old boss in with the new. Same thing.
Dislocation of the German war effort, all the rest of
it. There is, however, no mention of ball bearings.
they've finally gone off. All right, okay. We'll leave the ball bearings off this time.
So priority... I mean, it's interesting because there's a first priority, which is one thing, and then there's a second priority, which is three different categories.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's a piece of bureaucraties. It's quite interesting.
Yeah.
First priority, one, petroleum industry with special emphasis on petrol, gasoline, including storage. Second priority, German rail and waterborne transportation systems. Three, So this is three of...
So the one is petroleum.
Yes. And then
two is the German rail and waterborne transportation
system. But two is part of the second priority. So yes. So there's 1-1 and then there's 2-2.
Yeah.
2-3, tank production plants and depots, which is interesting. Ordnance depots. 4, MT, motor transport production plants and depots. So basically...
Exactly the same as before. With spots and tighter, both able to do transportation plan and oil plants concurrently.
Yeah. And if you want, you can get ball bearings out of that if you want.
And of course, the big thing is that Spots knows that his window to do precise air commerce
is closing really quickly.
Because of the weather, because it's autumn, because 20, the days...
25th days is past the equinox, so the six-month frame of daylight is ending.
And this is the crucial bit. And this, as we're getting into the winter, this whole debates about precise bombing, precision bombing, as opposed to area bombing, start really coming to the fore again, because 8th Air Force is only able to launch 3 completely visual attacks on oil targets in October. So it can attack... It can do non-visual.
Which is H2X.
Yes. And statistics are starting to emerge. You know, analysis, data analysis.
Yeah.
And what they discover after the war, there is then a fervor, which is the United States Strategic Bombing Survey, which is an exhaustive look into this. And of course, the results are incredibly disappointing.
Yeah.
Just as they were with the Butt Report in June 1941. And they show that only 2.2% of bombs dropped during 57 precision raids on synthetic fuel plants hit damageable buildings and equipment. And 87.1% spread over the surrounding areas.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they are relying on Spears people for a lot of that information, aren't they, after the war? So there's a little sprinkle of Spear going, actually, I did an amazing job despite everything you did to me. But yeah, I mean, those are not good figures, are they?
Well, they're not great, but that doesn't mean that they're not kind of, you know, their efforts are hitting home, because they clearly are. But of course, the new crisis that is now emerging in the end of 1944, beginning of 1945, we had the crisis the year before. The crisis was all about, are we going to be able to get to Overlord? There was no mention of precision targets.
No.
You know, this is just not a debate. The debate about precision bombing only comes to fore now that you've got 1,000 bombers every day to play with and 1,000 fighters, and you can kind of, you know, and you're arguing the toss over the targets, can you get to the targets?
And the end is in sight.
And what are you trying to do? And one of the problems they have, that they increasingly have to use H2X, which is a sort of variation of the British ground mapping radar.
Yeah.
The truth is, they're not as good at using it because they haven't been relying on it.
Yeah, and they don't have. And when they first take it on, they don't have any faith in it. You've also got a load of people who don't like the idea that they're not clapping their eyes on a target. So they send their worst crews to be trained on it. They don't take the training as seriously, and that's a year previously that they start with H2X, isn't it? But by this point, they absolutely need it.
They absolutely do. And of course, whereas Bomber Command has been using it since 1943, and their crews are trained up to use it, and it's an absolute given. So it's there's no mystery about it. There's no kind of sort of feeling their way with it. They've done all that.
Yeah.
And so this is the irony of the whole thing, that Harris is still going on about we can't be precise, but is actually being precise.
Yeah.
Whereas 8th Air Force is continually saying we only do precision bombing, but it's becoming less precise. And that's...
So it amounts to the same
thing. They're wrapping up in a different way. And it's interesting because of 148,807 tons of bombs dropped between the 1st of September 1944 and the 31st of December 1944, 81,654. So what's that?
It's more than half.
Are H2X guided, yeah. Of that, only 674 tonnes got within 1,000 feet of the aiming point.
Yeah.
In other words, they're area bombing. They are absolutely area bombing.
Yeah, yeah.
You can wrap it up however you like it, but that is what is happening.
So, Bomber Commander area bombing precisely, and the 8th Air Force are...
Precisely bombing inaccurately. Bombing in an area way. Yeah. That's exactly how it is.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the Bomber Command have got much more sort of tied up in what kind of ordnance they're dropping and all that sort of thing, and can drop more bombs too.
Because they've got bigger
bomb capacity that they're able to deliver more to the target.
Well, Bomber Command drops just a sniff under 1 million tons of bombs on Germany alone.
God,
18,000 tons of bombs on by the Luftwaffe on
again,
London.
How do they know how do they not know they've lost? I mean, it's testament.
That's before you do the kind of 600,000, whatever it is, yeah, tons of bombs that the Americans.
I mean, it's testament to how wrong people like Duet were, that the population will rise up and overthrow its government, yes, if it's treated like this.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And after all, he's the guy that set a lot of this thinking in motion. Although they're bombing through cloud, they can do what they like. They can put planes up whenever they want, go where they want.
But this is my point. So this is the crisis of the autumn of 1944, yeah, the fall of 1944. Yeah. He's no longer about long range fighters and will you be ready for Overlord. It is about morality, yeah, morality of what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because the scales are now so huge.
Yeah.
And they can roam at will to a certain extent. I mean, yeah, not entirely. Of course not. I mean, try saying that to a guy who was on a B-17,
yes, of course,
in November,
yeah,
1944. Yeah, yeah, but yeah, you know, so I don't want to sound glib.
Yeah.
But the truth is that the data they do have shows that 42% of the bombs dropped supposedly precisely fell more than 5 miles from the target.
That's butt report stuff, isn't it?
But they have the capacity now, yeah, to do precision raise if they need to.
Yeah.
You know, these you know, it is interesting that, I mean, I remember going to the synthetic fuel plant in Perlitz up in what is now Poland, and that was absolutely destroyed. But that was destroyed by a combination of 8th Air Force and 617 Squadron.
Yeah.
If you look at the Valentin submarine pen, U-boat pen that was built outside Bremen,
yeah,
that was destroyed in April 1945 by 617 Squadron.
Yeah.
You know, that is huge when you're on the ground, but it's not when you're at 20,000 feet.
No.
But and they actually hit it on the nail.
But because they're attacking, I mean, after all, the synthetic oil industry in Germany is an incredibly vulnerable thing because you do actually need, you can't disperse it, can you? It's not like fighter production, yep, where you can build a wing one place, engine somewhere else, stick them together in a, you know, another location. Germany's incredibly vulnerable, but also because it's coal, you know, yep, that they're making the oil from. There's a double vulnerability with attacking railways with the oil plant, isn't there?
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. So they dovetail perfectly. This is the point. There should be no debate about transportation plan versus oil plant.
No.
You have a transportation plan and an oil plant, yeah, and you run them concurrently. And yeah, there shouldn't be any issue with that at all. Yeah. And to be honest, I don't think there really was. I mean, yeah, you know, Tedder and Spots are talking to each other all the time.
Yeah.
There's no issue here. But you know, as John G. Davis, this guy who wrote this monumental book on Spots and the Strategic Air War, you know, he points out that, you know, what they're doing, because of the weather, they're hitting marshalling yards instead. They're hitting them very well, but a well-hit marshalling yard also means an incredibly well-hit city.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, of these variations, because you can't be as precise as you'd like them to be.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, if you're putting 300 bombers onto one marshalling yard, the idea that they will all hit it accurately is sort of, it's absurd, isn't it?
Yep. Yep.
I mean, you can see why the cruise missile is the answer to this problem, isn't it? Fly down someone's chimney, basically. Take out a,
yes, except of course, you know, they're,
except they miss two.
They miss two, and they're incredibly expensive, and you, yeah, run out of them, and then you just go back to the old ways, which is, yeah, exactly what's happened, you know, in Ukraine, isn't,
yeah,
it? Ditto in Gaza City, which has, yeah, just been systematically, yeah, destroyed.
Yeah.
I mean, the moment your targets are in a city, you can precisely hit that tower block, but you're still destroying it.
Yeah.
Even today.
Yeah. Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back for the return to Berlin.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking to invest? Start your journey by exploring exchange-traded funds with GlobalX ETFs. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs for short, create baskets of stocks, bonds, and other assets that you can buy in a single trade. GlobalX specializes in ETFs that track emerging trends, like the rise of artificial intelligence, as well as strategies aimed to generate income potential. Visit GlobalXETFs.com to discover how you can get started.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Jim and I there, I mean, we were quite despondent then, weren't we?
A little bit, yeah, we need to perk things up a bit, don't we? But I don't know how we're going to do that, actually, because it's all a bit grim.
It just gets worse. But also, this is the sort of airman's dream, isn't it? That you can roam the skies at will, hit what you want. You've defeated the Luftwaffe, essentially. You know, can't really make an effort anymore. It's all going according to plan, isn't it? It's the bitter business of this phase of the war.
Except that the Germans still aren't surrendering.
Yeah, yeah. So
they go back to Berlin.
Yeah.
Finally, on the 3rd of February 1945. And this is very much a kind of resurrection of the thunderclap idea, which is this idea that you just smother the target of a huge amount. And it's a massive raid.
Yeah.
1,437 heavies dispatched, of which 1,370 effective. I mean, the idea is to really shock the population. But there is a sort of feeling by now that the population of Berlin is so done in anyway.
Well, unshockable now. Unshockable. By this point, aren't they? Yeah. Oh, you're going to bomb us, are you?
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. And anyway, the Red Army's coming.
Yeah.
You know, a German civilian might feel like bigger fish to fry, actually, at this point.
Well, yeah, I guess so. And the other thing that I think is really interesting is when you look at those sort of desolate pictures of Berlin at the end of the war, and they're shocking. Actually, you can get those historic aerial views of Berlin on Google Maps. That is not the result of
the Red
Russian
Army.
Red Army. That is a result of Bomber Command and indeed the 8th Air Force as well.
And then, of course, most infamously, notoriously, I think is probably the right word, there's Dresden.
Yeah.
On the 13th, 14th February, which is
that's where Bomber Command come over.
Yeah, Bomber Command create a firestorm. 8th Air Force are there too with H2X bombing the marshalling yards. But, you know, the marshalling yards.
In
the middle of the city.
Hit the marshalling yards, hit the city. And they return again on the 15th and on the 2nd of March.
Yeah.
And the reason they do so is because the Soviet Union is asking them to do so repeatedly because it's a major rail hub. You know, Dresden is the... From Dresden, German troops go to south through the Brenner Pass into Italy. And they go east into the southern Eastern Front. I don't think anyone could ever argue that Dresden is not a legitimate target. It's just that the conditions are perfect for bombing, and just as they were on the crucial night for the bombing of Hamburg, and just as they
and
were
for
when the Luftwaffe came over on Coventry.
Yeah, and everything worked.
You know, Tammy Davis-Biddle writes this great line. She goes, "The attack on Dresden was at once routine and exceptional." It was routine because it was just yet another city, another marshalling yard they were hitting. It was exceptional because of the scale of destruction.
You know, this is the point at which the tempo of bombing is that it's a different town every day, and it's sort of Dresden's turn. And they have bombed it before. That's the other thing. It has been bombed before. On the 17th of February, you actually get, and this is really, really interesting because it goes to the heart of what, within the bomber people, a reporter for Associated Press says that Allied air chiefs had made the long-awaited decision to adopt deliberate terror bombing of German population centres as a ruthless expedient to hastening Hitler's doom. And that sort of...
Yes, and this is on Associated Press, which means it's one of these ones that gets...
On the wire service, so everyone gets it.
Everyone gets it. So it's absolutely everywhere, widely circulated. Arnold and Spots go mad at this.
Yeah.
We're not doing terror bombing.
Well, I mean...
Or are we?
Or it's just the wrong word. It's the wrong word.
Yeah.
Could we not call it that, please? But of course, the Goebbels leaps on that, puts an extra zero on the casualty figures, and because it's 25,000 people probably.
He always says 120,000.
Well, he goes up to a quarter of a million in his press release. You know, he sticks a zero on the end and says how you know it's terror bombing of the first order. Mm. And the Americans get themselves in a tangle, saying, no, we didn't do that. And, you know, they have deniability, haven't they? Which is the Bomber Command to do the firestorm. So Americans can point the finger, which is the part of the story of what's happening as the war comes to an end. Which is interesting, though, that at the same time in Japan, the switch is to firebombing shortly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, yes, there's sort of double standards going on and no consistency. And, you know, there is no one rule on this and no one strategy on this. And that's what I think is so interesting. You know, and then it's interesting, having then sort of desperately tried to sort of send out another message going, you know, we don't do terror bombing, we don't do this, you know, we don't do terror raids. What we do is precision daylight bombing. Yeah. They then start taking the lead, or 8th Air Force and Fred Anderson, who's the commander of 8th Bomber Command. then take the lead of Operation Clarion, which is a plan to disperse thousands of bombers and fighters all across Germany all at once to bomb and strafe transportation systems.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously they can justify that because, yeah, but we're doing it precisely. So it's
being
fine.
Done precisely, yeah. A dollop of hindsight here, but they knew perfectly well what they were actually capable of at this point. They're not saying we're doing it precisely because they think they're doing it precisely. They're saying it, aren't they? They know. The crews know. I mean, the crews in particular are not comfortable with a lot of this radar-guided bombing, are they? They don't like it. They're unhappy about it precisely because of the message about precision. Although these sorties are much safer, there's always a morale problem, isn't there? There's always a morale problem because it's so bloody dangerous.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Yep. They return to 8th Air Force returns to Berlin again.
Yep.
26th of February with 1,207 heavies dispatched.
That's incredible.
So almost a year from the first one.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then it's kind of, they're starting to wind down after that. Continuing doing transportation targets, oil targets throughout March 1945. But they're getting to the point where the troops are getting so far forward, you don't need the strategic bombers anymore. It's so clear that's the end. You can finally call to a halt. And on the 16th of April, Spot sends a directive to Jimmy Doolittle and to Nathan Twining of the 15th Air Force in Italy. And he says, the advances of the ground forces have brought to a close the strategic air war waged by the United States Strategic Air Forces and the Royal Air Force Bomber Command. It has been won with a decisiveness becoming increasingly evident as our armies overrun Germany. From now on, our strategic air forces must operate with our tactical air forces in close cooperation with our armies.
I'm always wary of saying, well, the war's about to end anyway. Because obviously no one knows that. They don't know if there's another month in it, 3 weeks, 2 months, 6 months, do they?
Yep.
But, I mean, you're over the Rhine by this point quite comfortably.
Yep.
The Red Army is just about to go for Berlin.
Yep.
So really, the war, I mean, it's different. It's because Dresden, very often with Dresden, people say, well, the war's about to end anyway. Why do they bother? It's February. Well, but that's, February to May is a long enough gap. But this is basically, it's what?
Well, and they're acknowledging that, aren't they? Yeah, they're saying, you know, if the ground forces want us to hit something, then we'll hit it. But basically, kind of, you know, smashing cities, we've done it. Well, there's nothing left to hit.
Yeah, basically bombing rubble.
You know, you've hit 61 cities in Germany of over... Yeah.
I think one of the things that sort of really, really becomes clear when you look at the air war like this is the extent to, Germany was destroyed. The country was destroyed.
Yep, completely.
I mean, I don't know. If you were born in 1920, you've a one in three chance of him being killed in combat, something like that in Germany. But Germany, in order to defeat Germany, they've had to. I mean, this isn't a negotiation, is it? There are no peace talks. This is about completely destroying the place, isn't it? Totally destroying it, which takes you a long way from the sort of industrial web way of looking at bombing. That all you got to do is hit the nodal points, and if you do for the oil or the bearings, you know.
And you know, the truth of the matter is the Reichsbahn finally does implode in February 45, and at that point, you know, it is game over. I mean, it was game over a long time before, but it's really game over.
Yeah.
They can't really do anything more. But I think it's worth just mentioning what happens to the 100th Bomb Group, because we started this whole series with them.
Yeah.
So good to kind of see where they finished up. And they've been kept going all this time.
Yeah.
You know, the originals have all gone, obviously. I've rotated back the very few that made it out or in prisoner of war camps. There's a whole other story about the 8th Air Force as well, personnel who are having to do these huge marches and stuff, which actually Don Miller's book goes into in some detail. Very kind of movingly.
And
as
I
well.
Think there's going to be some of that in
I think there is, yeah.
Master of the Air, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the 100th Bomb Group, who are operating from Fort Abbott, as we were mentioning, right in the first episode on the Suffolk-Norfolk border, but just inside Norfolk, their last mission is on Friday, the 20th of April, 1945. And it is to Oranienburg, which is where that Heinkel factory is.
Yeah.
Right next to Sachsenhausen.
Yeah.
Concentration camp. And although there's no air operations at all on the April the 19th, the noose is definitely tightening around around Nazi Germany at this point. General Eisenhower is declaring that the German armies are tottering on the threshold of defeat. The Russians reported at the gates of Berlin, while American lines are only 45 miles from the Russians. An Allied broadcaster, Slave Laborers, asked them to stay where they were, for in a few days, the gap between the armies of liberation from the West and from the East will be closed. So that's the kind of sort of background to this last mission on the 20th of April. 29 crews are seated in the Friday morning's briefing. So again, that again shows you the scale of just the bomb groups has gone up. Instead of kind of a dozen or 13 ships, it's now 29. The 100th is going to be flying to Oranienburg, some 7 miles north of the centre of Berlin, and they're first priority visual is going to be the marshalling yards and then the engine test beds at Recklin in Germany. So actually not the Heinkel works at all. So commanding the 100th this time is Major Stivers. You know, he's not even a glint in the milkman's eye back in
I know.
Kind of,
I mean, the
you
thing
know,
is,
August 1943.
An aircraft testing bed, engine testing bed.
What's the point?
What's the point? They might get an engine ready in the next fortnight.
Yeah, but you know, they might as well.
Yeah.
They might as well. 29 aircraft airborne by 0615. They head over there. They're absolutely fine. I mean, you know, the bombs away at 10:14.
Well, I really hope no crews were lost for an engine test bed in the last fortnight of the war. I mean, you know.
Yep, the rally point made good after the bombing. After 8 hours in the air, all ships returned. Ernest Kobel's ship, which is returned early because of his number 3 engine being out, is the only issue at all.
So that crew doesn't get, they don't get a sortie credit.
Yeah, it's like what? So bombing results, excellent. Aircraft lost, 0. Crew lost, 0. And then 5 days after that, it is the final heavy bombing mission by the 8th Air Force in the Second World War, in World War II, which is a series of raids on the Skoda Works at Pilsen, which is a hell of a long way, actually.
That's a long way, long
way. You know, Czechoslovakia and smaller targets in Australia. So this is now a tactical, not strategic mission requested by the ground forces. It's mission number 968.
Bloody hell. And they do take, I mean, 6 bombers are shot down.
And one of those bomb groups taking part is the 384th, which was the first one to take off on mission number 1.
God.
Back on the 70th of August 1942.
Oh, a long war.
Yeah. And the very next day, US and Soviet troops meet on the Elbe. I've been to that point, actually.
Have you?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. In total, 8th Air Force suffers around 28,000 killed in action, similar number POWs, 18,000 wounded, so a total of 72,000 casualties, which is 34% of those who flew. But obviously, that percentage has come down massively.
Yeah, it's the peak point in the second half of 1943.
Autumn of 1943 is definitely the nadir.
And so really, that raid on Berlin where 100th Bomber Group come back with no aircraft loss, no crew loss, they're standing on the shoulders of the experience and the battles fought.
Yeah,
in the 18 months before that, really.
Yeah.
And in particular, late 43, where in a way, 8th Air Force has to learn the lesson that it needs fighter escort in order to then make the decision to pivot to fighter escort.
Yep.
So they have to go through that in order to figure that out, which is bitter business of the ideological grip, really, that the bomber men have on the.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. I think we should finish with Bert Stiles, because there's an interesting story about him. Because after 20 missions with Sam Newton, he then has to sit out a few because new pilots are coming in. And what happens is these new pilots come in and they have to do before they're going to be lead pilots, they need to do a stint as second pilots.
Yeah.
So the second pilots on a sort of well-established crew often have to sort of sit out a few.
Right.
And sometimes they get promoted up and take on their own. You know, if you've done 20 missions, you're not going to take on your own ship because it's too disruptive to the rest of the crew.
Yeah.
So he then ends up in this little kind of sort of hiatus and eventually joins he sits out a couple and does a couple more with Sam Newton. But by the time Sam Newton crew and the rest of the crew, or most of the crew, have done 35 missions, Stiles has only done 23. He then eventually joins another crew and he finishes with 4 missions in 5 days at one point, where he gets 15 hours sleep in total. He's absolutely knackered. But his last 2 missions are Augsburg and then completes his 35th of a long trip to Leipzig. And it's amazing, you know, if you'd been told back in kind of October 1943 that those were your last 2 missions, you'd think, I'm never going to make them. But the summer of 1944, it's like, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. The odds have changed.
And the interesting thing is he then writes his book and he has an opportunity to go back to the US and become an instructor, but he doesn't. He decides to reapply and volunteer for a second tour, but this time on fighter planes.
Really?
Yeah. And he completes his conversion in the UK, and he gets posted to the 505th Fighter Squadron, which is part of the 339th
yep.
Fighter Group, one of the new, comparatively new. I mean, they're not even on the, again, they're not a glint in the milkman's no. eye in back end of 1943, but now are kind of sort of full of old war horses.
And they're Mustangs.
And they're flying the P-51D, yeah. which That's is the newer version, which yeah. is coming in the summer, which is that one with the kind of bubble yeah. canopy yeah. That you and I kind of flew in.
Yeah.
And it's interesting looking at the last page of Serenade of the Big Bird, because I'm not going to do the American accent this time. He goes, "It's summer and there is war all over the world. The war has spread from Normandy to Brittany, and the American columns are swinging in towards Paris. There is still plenty of war in Russia. The same war is still going on in the islands and the sky over Japan. I can think about it in terms of moments and chunks and stretches of eternity measured in minutes. So far, I've lived through it. So far, the Lady of Luck has let me come through. There is hope as bright as the sun that it will end soon. I hope it does. I hope to hell it does." But unfortunately, on the 26th of November 1944, he's flying his 16th mission of this second tour, and he's at around 26,000 feet over Hanover when he gets embroiled in a dogfight. And what happens is he follows the plane down because, you know, they're doing that by yeah. this time so that they can strafe stuff on the way out. He shoots down the 109, but then somehow, obviously, just comes in too low,
yeah,
and crashes in and gets killed. By the time he dies, he's got a DFC, Distinguished Flying Cross, Purple Heart, Air Medal of Oak Leaf Cluster, and an amazing memoir and a stack of short stories which have subsequently been published as well. And the final bit of the book, the last paragraphs, really, really poignant, because he's trying to kind of make sense of the war and what it's all about. And he goes, "In the end, it is only people that count. All the people in the whole world. Any land is beautiful to someone. Any land is worth fighting for to someone. So it isn't the land. It's the people. That is what the war is about, I think. Beyond that, I can't go very far. So if we can get through with this war, I'll get started." What a tragedy.
God, it's terrible.
But it's a brilliant book.
Yeah.
Brilliant
yeah.
book.
Yeah.
And one of the many that fought and died with, one of those 28,000 that fought and died with the Mighty Eighth. And it was a Mighty Eighth, wasn't it? It's a mighty Air Force, which is you know, like all the great armies of the Second World War. It's been through its baptism of fire. It's been through its trials and tribulations. Mm. It's faced down danger.
And central to the Allied victory.
And central to the Allied victory.
No, I mean, no, I think no two ways about it. And even if you know, it's a strategic air force. Its effect is strategic. There's no doubt about that. Whether it's the strategy it set out with to have strategic effect with is I think the sort of locus of the debate, isn't it? They destroy the German air force, the Luftwaffe.
They make Overlord possible.
They make Overlord possible.
And there's no question that despite the extraordinary contribution of Bomber Command, and you absolutely can't deny that, when it comes to clearing the airspace over Northwest Europe, 8th Air Force has taken the lead on that. Yeah. Supported by Bomber Command and 2nd Tactical Air Force and 9th Air Force.
But Bomber Command couldn't have done that on its own.
No.
Because in the end, you need to bring the fighters to fight in daylight. Over Germany, so attacking aircraft production and then later on attacking oil is the thing that brings the Germans to battle and allows them to destroy them. And it is that thing though that we keep coming back to this, that the gear, the kit, the stuff, and it is a story of gear and kit and stuff, and the B-17 improves, and they
yep.
electronic aids to get them into battle and to get them over their targets, and then
yep.
the fighter wing improves.
Yep.
And they finally end up with the absolutely ideal aircraft for the moment in the P-51.
Yep.
With the drop tanks, with the technology, but in the end, the hardware is one thing; it's the software, it's the people.
Well, Bert Stiles is absolutely right. It's all about the people. How those boys did it, and how they got themselves into those ships and took off through a murky autumn of 1943 and
how anyone's persuaded to do it.
How do you do it? I just, you know, you can only be in awe of that, can't you? I mean, that is the bottom line.
Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this series of podcasts about the Mighty Eighth. 1944, obviously a year chock full of stuff, as is 2024. Because don't forget, there's our We Have Ways Festival.
Yep.
In July, July 18th to the 21st, a Black Pit Brewery near Silverstone. Talks, tanks, tankards, the company of other people similarly afflicted with fascination with this subject, and we'll be delving deep into the event.
And how could anyone not say the subject is fascinating when you've just been through the story just of the 8th Air Force?
The 8th Air Force.
The swings are roundabouts, the peaks are troughs. It's just an amazing story.
For me, this starts with the Airfix box of the B-17.
Yes.
Where it was a B-17G, that model kit, and it was one of those pieces.
Oh, no,
It was a G. What was I remember about this? One of his engines is on fire on the box art. You think, what'd you do that for? Oh God!
Well, when you go and see Sally B, which is the only B-17 flying in the UK, you see they have this trick where they kind of have smoke coming out of one of the engines.
Please don't. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you very soon with more 1944. Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, US Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics US, brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.